still can't believe we made that character with the Character Creation Forge.
It's a good build. It's a good build.
check out the George Washington episode if you want to know what we're talking about.
Right around April 1st, for some reason.
Yeah. Live from the Mundangerous Penitent Engine in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 99 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about character failure and redemption. But first, the crew of His Enduring Light eat a meal in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Cursebreaker makes mages rage and wizards weep in the Character Creation Forge.
So today, part three of our series on Tribality, the annotated history of Bran Talondro, has been released.
So altogether now, you should have about 9,000 words of Bran.
Yeah, of us talking about what Bran is and will be. It also features some artwork from Quinn Wilson. And one of the things that you guys have been asking for the longest time, an actual character sheet.
Although it is the character sheet that...
For a different game.
For the 5e playtest.
Yeah.
And keep reading after the sheet, because there are a few corrections.
Yeah. And also, like, there were some pretty big changes that happened between the playtest and 5th edition. Namely, multiclassing spells works differently. So, I wouldn't necessarily use that as the basis for any of your own characters.
Right, but if you want to, you know, take the level breakdown and play that at, what, level 8?
Yeah.
Go for it. It's still a good build. Also, up online right now is the first part of my Masks actual play set in Young Justice. That's the superhero TV show from a few years ago that's actually getting a season 3 now. It was put together by Rich Howard from the Whelmed podcast, friend of the show. That's at crashingthemode.com. He got together a pretty great group of people. It was run by Brendan Conway from Magpie Games, who's the creator of Masks, which is powered by the Apocalypse Engine game that lets you emulate young superheroes really well. Rich himself played Robin, Dick Grayson.
Big surprise there.
Yeah, I know, right?
Rich plays Robin.
Uh-huh. His very favorite character of all time. His co-host Emily Buzo was Miss Martian. Neil Powell from the DM's Block played Kid Flash. And Darcy Ross from Cypherspeak and Contessa was Aqualad. I got to play Connor, Superboy. And the actual play opens at the high school graduation of Connor and Miss Martian, and then goes basically to Atlantis from there.
Oh, a Rich Howard game that goes underwater.
A Darcy surprise. Ross game that goes underwater.
Yeah. Great.
You know what? It did really offset the fact that Superboy can't fly.
Yeah.
It was handy.
I can imagine. But can he float?
Well enough.
But can he crow?
No. He can't. All right, so check that out, and we'll put a link up in the show notes.
And also some D&D news that we haven't talked about yet. So they announced a few weeks ago the next player book available. They always talk about adventures, and we don't. But the next player book available for D&D 5e will be Xanathar's Guide to Everything, November 21st.
This is pretty exciting because we are going to be getting a bunch of new subclasses for all of the different classes. I think every class gets two new subclasses except for Wizard, which gets just one.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's not Lore Wizard.
I guess we'll see.
We are also getting a bunch of new feats and spells. And then apparently there's some information for GMs. But for the most part, it's a player book.
Do we know for sure that Mystic isn't going to be a new class?
It is going to Adventurers League playtest along with Artificer. So they didn't, at least they haven't said that there will be any new classes in Xanathar's yet.
Okay. Well, maybe.
We'll see what happens. But get your copies. We'll be doing a full review of it and start thinking about what you want us to be building in the Forge with these new options.
Yeah. And it also is being released similar to Volo's Guide with the game store like special edition cover, the similar kind of line art style. It actually looked pretty cool, and I think it has some color in it this time, which is nice.
Yeah, and it'll be, I think, probably 2 weeks early at local gaming stores.
If your store is in the right tier of Wizards of the Coast patronage.
Right, so early November.
And then final reminder, please get your mailbag questions in for episode 100, which is next week. We are doing all mailbag and some announcements. Get them in by Friday night if possible, because Saturday we might not see them before we record.
Yeah, and you know, you definitely want them answered.
Yeah,
on the fly.
Yeah,
without much prep.
Just like we answer your emails. Also, if you've sent us an email in the past couple of weeks, your question is also a candidate for the mailbag.
Yeah, you can send questions to totalpartythrill@gmail.com. Also on Twitter @TPTcast.
Oh, should we put a hashtag on there so we can find them again?
Oh, yeah, that's probably a good idea.
#TPT100.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah. Mystery. Build mystery.
All right, speaking of building mystery and also on the fly and not much prep, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules from Fantasy Flight Games. And the Rogue Traders have recently arrived on the feudal world Gontalgrim after a brief detour as captives of Dark Eldar. You are bringing along some passengers who came from the planet.
They're not passengers. They're not paying. That's the problem.
Oh, right.
Yeah. They're cargo.
They're rescuees, if you will.
Sure.
But you have made landfall, were greeted by an Imperial Guard colonel, which was a bit of a surprise, as well as the Duke of Leannisport, the capital city. And then you were kind of left to your own devices for a while with an invitation to dinner that evening.
Oh, there's nothing we like more than free food.
Right. And as members of the void-faring nobility, as rogue traders, you made an entrance. You put on your Sunday's best and showed up to dinner. You were announced before a large crowd in this beautifully appointed kind of cathedral-like chamber with a long table set for 100. And then you had to role play a social encounter.
Yeah, that was difficult. I mean, we made a splash when we walked in, right? Flair rolled in with his full entourage. He's actual nobility. He's got a train and people are carrying it. And everyone is named Felipe because who cares what their names actually are?
This is an ongoing joke for Flair's character, was that he called all of his servants or his attendants Felipe because that was the head attendant and he didn't want to tell the difference between them.
And the rest of us had on our dress skulls. I think even Echo had like a gown on.
A slightly less stained shirt.
Right.
Less ink stains.
But yeah, our characters are not really specced for social combat.
Yeah, this is very fish out of water for you guys. You're also mostly not nobility. You're playing the part of rogue traders under a warrant of trade, but you're not an actual rogue trader. You're the crew of a rogue trader.
Also, you have to like give up your guns before you go into this room, and that's just weird.
Yes, very Firefly-esque in that regard.
So we started, carousing and socializing, as you do.
Yeah, so one of the rules of this encounter was that you were not going to be able to just stand in a pack of six people and let two of them speak, because that's not really how parties work. And so, you guys had to kind of spread out and mingle, and you all had your own kind of goals for what you were going to do here. And you were able to quickly determine the hierarchy of things, right? Which were the major houses, they were all kind of color coordinated, and who were the power players, and who should you speak to, and who could help you with this, and who could give you the lay of the land, and who should you not insult over their dead son?
Yeah, fortunately, like any essentially medieval town, visiting nobility is a novelty. So people wanted to talk to us.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned Firefly earlier, but I definitely took like Shindig as a primer for what to do in this party. So like Trank shoots guns. That's what he does. So he looked for the person with the highest military rank, made a beeline to them and started shooting this shit about weapons.
Right.
So you got some Lazlocks, huh? That's better than what you got, I suppose. But, you know, it'd be really great if you had repeaters.
Yeah. You know, the Mars Prime pattern of the last gun is like really a fine specimen. Though they say the action locks up on occasion.
That's a nice bolt pistol you got there. This one's mine. Right. I call her Vera. Not all of us were that successful, though.
No. Mm. So part of those rules of having to spread out meant that some of your characters who are not built for socialization...
Not people.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were given the opportunity to fail. And that... That happened when Echo ran up on a baron named Baron Darendil.
Oh, Baron Darendil.
And now you might recall one of the orcs in your prison cell.
One aboard, of our refuge orcs.
Aboard refuse orcs? Refuge?
Refuge orcs. It's a refugee orc.
Aboard the Dark Eldar trap was named Prince Darendil. And he was, if you recall, an orc who insisted that he was a member of the Galtalgrim nobility who had been turned into an orc.
Yeah, we could not figure out if he was telling the truth. We could tell that he believes he's telling the truth.
Right.
So we brought him with us.
Yeah. And so Echo starts, recognizes the name, and as Echo does, starts prodding down that path. Come to find out that she grossly insulted the Baron as she demanded he recount the tale of his son's death on the battlefield and how he was buried without a body, because it turns out he died in the midst of a firefight at the time that the Dark Eldar raided, offering you no light into the situation of your passenger, but also... grossly insulting a member of the nobility.
Yeah, perhaps not the most tactful thing to say. I don't think that's how it happened. That seems unlikely.
Yeah. Have you ever wondered?
But is it possible that he didn't actually die and that you had a funeral for nothing?
Well, long story short, Echo finished her meal in the servants' quarters. As she proved to be too much of a liability.
Please go talk to the cooks.
Though she did prove to be rather handy because you would run messages to her, mm-hmm. and given her lore skills, she was able to kind of give you some context. So her encyclopedic memory of all of the data slates on Galtalgrim proved to be quite useful in the rest of your encounters.
So after dinner, the rest of us were able to regroup and sort of compare notes. We did realize that we've got two competing groups of bidders here on this planet for the ration bars that we're offering from Nova Bella, who could potentially offer us the ag equipment that we're looking for.
Yeah, and they basically have two different directions that they would go with that deal, right? How they would change Galtalgrim. And we'll get into that later, because all you've really figured out in this decision is that, great, we can drive up the price. Yeah.
There's also an Imperial tactician on this world named Biota, who seems to be commanding the war effort. He is very well versed in the Tactica Imperialis, so well versed, in fact, that he refuses to deviate from it in any way, which is, you know, how you're basically supposed to run the Imperial Guard.
Well, right, because you're supposed to fight using the Tactica Imperialis with fully equipped Imperial Guardsmen.
And also faith.
And
faith in the Emperor. Yeah. You lead with your faith and your face.
And your las gun.
Right. They don't have those.
They're missing those las guns. Those are important.
So he's one reason the war effort is going poorly.
Right. So it turns out this has created a couple problems, right? First of all, they need reinforcement on the front lines. They're just churning through bodies of the Imperial War Machine, story of the Imperial Guard, right. But at a rate that's unsustainable because they don't have the firepower they need. And then as a result of that, these people... see a giant ship come in the sky with these rich rogue traders who've gone gallivanting about the galaxy and spreading the Imperial faith, and by the might of the Emperor, they've got some armsmen, right? They can certainly offer us some armsmen.
Yeah, a ship that size must have a crew of hundreds of thousands of people.
Uh-huh.
except that they don't know that we're severely understaffed and the whole ship is being held together with like pieces of wire.
Yeah. They think you got people.
Right. We're not offering because we don't have anything to offer, but they don't know that and we can't tell them that.
Yeah. So you keep politely declining and like changing the conversation every time it comes up.
Would be great if we could get reinforcements from somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what, you got any leads on that?
If only there were a ship that wasn't flying in space right now.
Right.
Full of men with guns.
Yeah, man, it's hard luck. You know, everywhere in the galaxy, it's tough.
Just keep having faith. We got a preacher. You want a sermon?
Yeah. So as a result of this, morale and discipline at the front is suffering. It's almost like they're suffering from a severe lack of maybe a half dozen commissars who never made it to the planet.
Would those commissars have been flying in, oh, I don't know, a gun cutter?
Well, you did find, I believe, 6 Imperial bolt pistols.
We did.
6 storm coats.
That I've just flashed around this party.
and a number of commissariat badges aboard the gun cutter. So yeah, I think it's safe to say you're flying in their ship.
Okay. Well, they were stitched into a human mosaic by the Dark Eldar, so...
That's true. They weren't going to make it.
And they weren't using it, so...
Right.
We also find out that there was a large supply drop of las guns that was knocked far off target and ended up landing behind enemy lines, so on the other side of the orc front. There's no way that these people are going to be able to get it.
Yeah, they just don't have the technology or the firepower or the manpower to spare.
Mm-hmm. We have a gun cutter.
And a tow cable.
Huh. I have a feeling we might have to say yes to this job.
Yeah, so you kind of get cornered a little bit by Colonel Sturm and Commissar Herc, who has now noticed your accoutrement.
And we said no to the 10,000 troops,
right?
So,
so okay, so you're not going to give us the troops. You better give us our guns.
And you know what? We'll see how poorly that goes next week.
So this week we are talking about character falls and redemption arcs. This was a topic suggested to us by David, one of our listeners. And the basic idea here is that a character has screwed something up and now needs to make amends.
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways that a character can screw up, you know, some sort of sin or just making a mistake, or they could be evil.
Yeah, so I think as far as RPGs, there's probably 4 main fall stories. So we'll talk about this from like a fall and then a redemption, right?
Because mm-hmm.
they kind of...
Yeah, let's talk about screwing it up.
Let's talk about it in order. So I think moral corruption or failure, moral failure are one of the easy ones. And this goes back to like to the early days of D&D, right? Like the lawful good paladin commits an evil act and he... literally, mechanically falls, mm-hmm. right? But any good character doing evil, or I mean, I suppose even an evil character doing good could qualify as a moral failing.
Right. Or even think about a neutral character, right? A character whose alignment or like outlook hasn't even really been defined, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like this happens a lot with newer players or in a new campaign where you have someone come in and they haven't really decided what the personality of this character is. But you present them with options, you present them with moral quandaries, and then... maybe they make, in context of the campaign, quote-unquote, very bad decisions.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the kind of character that is sort of the opposite of this, who has clearly defined rules that they're going to live by. We see this, obviously, in like old-school paladins with their code of conduct. But there are a lot of RPG archetypes in general that have a code by which they live, the way of the samurai. An oath to a monk order or belonging to a particular type of religion that prescribes, you know, how you act or, you know, certain activities that you need to undertake. And in the course of adventuring or a campaign, there can be times when you either don't do those or you actively do the opposite. You've broken an oath that you have made.
Yeah, so I think of Jaime Lannister in Game of Thrones, right? He was sworn to defend the king. He was a member of the King's Guard, and then when the king goes crazy, it's Jaime Lannister who kills him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it prevented a massacre. It would have cost thousands of lives. The world almost certainly would have been better off without the king, and yet he is still the Oathbreaker, right? Mm-hmm. He has fallen from grace. Another thing to think about outside of like a fantasy setting, any type of like life debt or some sworn oath or sworn protector, those types of things. And this usually is more related to willfully violating those oaths rather than failing to uphold them, right?
Mm-hmm. A lot of times the trope is someone who is forced into breaking the oath, like Lannister, right? It's a rock and a hard place,
right?
Or I see it a lot in, you know, Klingon culture in Star Trek. You, by the letter of the law, have broken your oath, probably because it was poorly made when you were like, I will never do this thing, or yeah, I will always do this thing.
Right.
But then circumstance comes up and it is either do something horribly immoral or uphold your oath. Usually the character is forced into, you know, breaking the oath, and then now you have a new kind of path that they're heading down.
Right. And then that stands, of course, in contrast to failure, which is, you know, you had the opportunity to do something and you were not successful in doing it. So that could be related to an oath, but it could also be as simple as, you know, missing the game-winning shot could send your character down the path of falling, right? It's like the Super Bowl hangover, right? Like the team who loses the Super Bowl never makes it back to the Super Bowl the following year. Like you just can't, right? It just it's too big of a burden.
Or the soccer player who misses the shot in the World Cup and their team loses, never makes it back home.
Well, depends on which country is hosting. A lot of the superhero archetypes use failure as that like launch point for a superhero's career, right? Mm-hmm. Is you have this power, you fail to do something with it, and then you must like rededicate yourself to that power to sort of redeem yourself for that failure.
Right. And I think it's important to make a distinction. Failure is when a character is actively trying to do something or prevent something or whatever, right? They are giving it their all and they still don't succeed. But contrast that with our fourth option, which is a mistake. It might be that the character didn't try because they didn't necessarily know that they should be, that this is something that they should have been preventing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Peter Parker.
Right.
Like he ignores the robbery and it ends up getting Uncle Ben killed.
Right. Could he have stopped the robber? Easily.
Yeah.
Right? He just didn't even try to
he
do it.
He was just in a mood.
Yeah.
So I think mistake is often dealing with unintended consequences, whereas failure and maybe unknown consequences, right? Whereas mm-hmm. failure is usually unintended but known. Like you know what the cost of not succeeding is going to be, and you're dealing with that. Whereas a mistake is you learn about the costs kind of after the fact, and that sends you into that fall spiral.
Yeah, both can have similar outcomes, certainly guilt.
Shame is another one.
I like that for all of these, this scale can vary depending on the size of your campaign or just the arc that the player wants to have. It can have consequences that change the entire world, right? Like killing a king probably has very large repercussions for at least an entire nation, maybe even more.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at Peter Parker, like Uncle Ben dying doesn't affect New York City. Nobody cares except for Peter and his aunt.
Right.
But they are, it's a huge looming part of his character from then on forever.
Yeah, I mean that's actually a perfect contrast with like Jaime Lannister, right? Where killing the king, his guilt from that comes from the entire rest of the world rejecting him mm-hmm. as the Oathbreaker, as the Kingslayer rather, not because of anything that he suffers internally.
Right, right? He knows this was the right thing to do, yeah. And if I had to do again, I would do the same thing.
Right. Yeah. This isn't a big theme of D&D, but...
maybe not your D&D.
Okay, fair enough. But romance is another good sort of source for these types of falls for a character, especially on a very small scale, right? Like that whole idea of like, you know, like that teenage emo thing where it's like, oh, she got close to me and she hurt me, so I'll never let anybody get close to me again, right?
Are you supposed to grow out of that?
Yeah, you are. Turns out.
Remember that each of these different like categories that we're talking about, there certainly can be a lot of crossover. Because if you think about something like Lancelot and Guinevere, that's a romance story. But it is also about betrayal, right? He's breaking an oath to his king.
Well, so is she.
Different kind of oath, yes. Yeah. And then eventually, of course, it leads to like the downfall of an entire kingdom.
Right, right.
And ultimately a way of life. Like all of these things end up happening, beginning with this one dalliance.
Turned out all right for Galahad.
Everything always turns out fine for him. He's a Mary Sue. Okay.
I know. He is. Oh, you're so perfect. You can find the Holy Grail. Oh. So what are the forms that the fall will manifest in an RPG character? Like, what are the role-playing notes that you want to hit if your character is fallen?
Right. So these will be like particular role-playing ways that it pans out, not necessarily in the mechanics of the game.
Yeah, and this is important because a fall in a role-playing game only really makes sense if you're role-playing it that way, mm-hmm. right? Like, characters fail all the time, right? Like you could have a TPK or a near TPK at any point, and, you know, you just, like, pick up your gear and you go on to the next dungeon.
Yeah, oh, we didn't save the NPC. Well, that sucks. I guess we get his loot.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that happens all the time in games, right? Uh-huh. But when you decide that, you know, an event happens that affects your character, what are the ways that you can sort of portray to everybody that this is truly a fall arc for my character, not just a minor setback?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've already talked a bit about guilt. And I think this is probably one of the most common responses to a mistake or a failure. Probably less so to something like oath breaking, because for the most part, characters, when they break an oath purposefully, feel like they're doing it for the right reason.
Yeah.
You know, in the moment.
Yeah, I think a lot of times you might have shame then.
Right.
Right, where the external consequences of an action are what cause you to fall rather than the internal feelings about that action. Right. So Jaime Lannister doesn't feel bad for a moment about killing the king. Jaime Lannister feels terrible that everybody looks at him with that judgmental look of, you're the greatest swordsman to have ever lived, and you did it to break your own oath, right? Like, you are the Kingslayer. Like, we will never value you the way we looked up to you before.
Yeah, and I think the way this often manifests in the game, or in the mind of a character at least, is, you know, when you're guilty, when you're feeling guilty, you would rather not be alone, right? Because that just sort of magnifies the guilt that you're feeling from within. When you're feeling shamed, being alone is actually, it can be a solace, because you don't have the like staring eyes or the whispers.
Yeah.
But of course, both of those can manifest in a profound sense of loss. You know, you no longer have what you had before. You no longer have your uncle who's dead.
Right. You no longer have your title or your standing. Mm-hmm. You no longer have your nobility.
You no longer have your god.
Yeah. Or in the case of D&D paladins, you no longer have your paladin abilities.
Right.
You're a fighter now.
A terrible fighter with no feats.
Meanwhile, the fighter's like, hey, what am I, chopped liver? Like, you know, I got a pretty good life here. 4 attacks.
That faith got you pretty far, huh? Maybe, I don't know, try practice.
Mm. And then I think another thing, another feeling that works well in RPGs is abandonment. The idea that something has happened and you have no reason to go on, right? That the sort of ultimate loneliness, right? A lot of times that sets you up for that redemption of, I rededicate myself to the party, right? I become a better team player, or I do whatever it is that the party is doing. I fully invest myself in that, and that becomes sort of my purpose.
Mm-hmm. Another way that can happen is if the response is anger,
mm-hmm.
you know, like frustration that, like, this is unfair, fundamentally unfair. I was forced into this. I did the right thing. Or, you know, anger at yourself, like guilt can certainly manifest as anger. That is a motivation that I think ends up being a lot more active in terms of the game. So if you want a character who has something bad happen, who fails, but then uses that as like a way to propel them forward into something, even if it's not necessarily a good thing they're propelling themselves into, right? But who may say, okay, I'm going to get much better at combat, or, you know, I'm just going to throw myself into spells, you know, in my spell book, that's an opportunity.
Yeah, that was very much Bran's arc, was like, oh, I failed at one thing one time. I will never be hit again. I'm going full defense now. Like, I will never not be the last one standing.
That hurt.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually a really good note. However this guilt manifests, right? Like, role-playing it at the table is important, but also keep in mind that there's other players at the table mm-hmm. that have their characters with their feelings, and there's also sort of this overarching plot that you're already engaged with, right? So role-play that, but also make sure that you're still propelled forward in the story. Like, don't let one failure sort of drag down the whole campaign and now nobody can have fun because my character had a bad day.
Right, or like now you become the loner who like doesn't adventure with the party. Well, okay, they leave you behind.
Leave the party, yeah. Right. I mean, which is fine actually. Mm-hmm. I mean that was one of the things that I had considered at a point in the Morning Glory campaign.
I tried so hard to get you to leave.
Yeah,
not Brand.
Me,
which is a shame. Yeah.
So sometimes that's fair too, but I think the longer term the campaign, the more you can let this kind of spiral as well, right? Where like, that anger leads you to a rash decision that causes more problems for yourself. Ideally, you don't want that to reflect totally on the party and not on yourself.
Unless the party's doing it all together.
Right. Lead the party into mistakes. Don't force the party into mistakes. But that sort of thing where, like, you know, you have been excommunicated from your church, and when they send someone to you to sort of recall you for a trial or whatever, you kill that person, right? That's an intensely personal moment that is going to cause that fall to continue to spiral for you, but isn't derailing the campaign, right? Until mm-hmm. the entire Inquisition comes after you for heresy. That's called a fun complication.
I mean, the witch hunters are coming. That's sounds like a really fun arc.
Right, yeah.
And they don't care that, like, you're just my traveling companion.
Right. You are abetting a heretic. You too must burn with the witch.
So sorry about that. I'll apologize later, but let's not die first.
Right.
As a GM, I think, you know, once you have characters who've fallen, it's important to make sure that there are consequences, but those consequences don't keep your player from like having fun and don't keep a character from being useful in a party. And I think this is why, one of the reasons that we've moved away from second edition paladins like losing all their abilities, because it's like, great, now you've set up this redemption arc, but in order to get there, they can't do anything.
Yeah, well, 3.5 took it the opposite direction, where it was like, cool, you've fallen, here's a whole new set of abilities and they're more powerful.
Right. Why would you not fall?
Of course I'm falling. I'm only getting this strong so I can fall.
Right.
I'm going to dive.
Right. I'm going to go to the Blackguard Bank right now and cash in all these paladin levels.
Right.
I like the 5th edition. I guess the fiction of it is that like when you become a paladin, you are invested with a certain amount of power from your deity
mm-hmm.
and like
from your oath,
yeah, you know, because it doesn't need to be a deity, it could be though, and then, you know, if you break it, you still are invested with that power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't go anywhere, you didn't unlearn your spells. So when it comes time to pull yourself out of that nosedive, I mean, assuming that you've decided that your arc is to do that and not to like crash and burn.
Yeah, I mean, crashing and burning is fine too.
Yeah
In fact, crashing and burning is what will happen to Draco.
Hmm.
In Dynasty Unwarranted.
I mean, he'll certainly burn.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So there are a lot of ways that this can happen. And, you know, work with your player, work with your GM to talk about what form you want it to take. And I don't mean, like, if you're a player, don't, like, write it right out of story, here's how I want it to happen, and hand it to your GM, you know? But you can say, yeah, like, I want this to be a difficult road, or, you know, I want to deal with these consequences for a while, but I want the resolution to actually be kind of simple because I don't want to dwell on it for too long,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. So in its simplest form, you can just write whatever wrong caused you to fall. obviously you can't bring Uncle Ben back to life. Well, actually in D&D,
plenty of games you can.
Yeah. And actually that would be a good arc. Okay, you know, I through negligence a family member of mine died. I will quest as a cleric until I can cast Raise Dead, and then I will go raise them from the dead.
Right. I will bring their body with me everywhere I go until I can bring Raise Dead and a 500 gold piece diamond.
Right. Every 10 days I cast Gentle Repose again.
Yeah.
They don't smell. It's fine. This is, I think, from the cartoon Conan the Adventurer, right? His family's turned to living stone. So the whole reason he's out there is adventuring is to, like, find Rathamon and get him to, like, undo the spell.
Wait, is that really the plot of Conan the Adventurer?
The cartoon, yeah, from, like, the 90s.
That, like, totally misses the character of Conan.
It did a lot of things wrong, yes.
Wow. As somebody who's recently read too much Conan...
But it can get way more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, you can take a fall, and rather than righting the wrong, you seek to prevent future wrongs, right? So it's not good enough to just atone for the mistakes that I made. I must also make sure that no one ever makes this mistake again, right? I wielded this power irresponsibly, so now we must destroy the power.
Right. In terms of Spider-Man again, like... The character loses something if Uncle Ben is able to be brought back to life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I've heard people say that, like, in all of comics, you know, people come back to life all the freaking time.
Yeah.
The only characters that can never, ever come back are Peter Parker's Uncle Ben
mm-hmm.
and Batman's parents.
Yeah.
Those people need to stay dead.
Right.
And, like, no one wants to see them alive again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, of course, Peter Parker now, he's out to stop all the crimes that... could end in tragedy the same way that his did.
Right.
And of course, Batman is just driven by being, you know, psychotic and watching his parents killed when he was 9.
Yeah. I mean, he ostensibly wants to clean up the city, but not enough that it stops being profitable for Wayne Enterprises, who seems to be behind 90% of the corruption in the city.
Hey. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Rich, fix this if you want. Yes. You can weigh in and school us. But he definitely suffers from extraordinary PTSD.
Yeah, Iron Man does the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's guilty about
just
all of
way
his,
more selfish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's killed everybody else with his weapons. So keep in mind, what redemption is really defined by the audience. So you can have redemption that is internal to the PC, where the PC is her own audience, right? So... you're looking at how does the PC feel about it? How does she recognize that she's fallen? Like, does she recognize that she's failed or that she's made a mistake? And then what would make her feel that she's gotten the ledger even? You know, like, what gets her to feel like, yes, I've righted the wrong that I've committed?
Yeah, when the player is the audience, and, you know, a lot of that role play sort of happens... internally or sort of like as a short monologue at the table, it can actually be very simple. Something as simple as, you know, I saved one child,
right?
You know, and now, like, I feel better because it wasn't really my fault in the first place.
Yeah.
Or you can drag it out and now that becomes a personality trait.
Right.
Like, they're never really getting there.
Yeah, like, I will always save children.
Right. And, you know, as a GM, like, either one of those is great. You know, either one of those is character building and story building.
Yeah, and I think as a player playing this, right, it's good to vocalize that internal monologue mm-hmm. for the benefit of the other people, right? Of, okay, so this is the situation that she sees herself in. This is what she's experienced with this. This is how she feels. And so this is how she will act.
Yeah.
Right.
And it makes for a better story at the table, right? Like, if you're talking tactically, the battle map is out. As a player, you can say, okay, well, I mean, she's still reeling from, like, the mistake that she made 2 months ago. There is absolutely no way that she's not going to run directly over to this child here and shield them. So that's what she does.
Right. And sorry, I will not be offering lay on hands to you,
right.
Fighter who has been taking the dragon.
I'm saving them for the kids.
Right. And then everybody goes, oh... Yeah, I mean, I guess redemption comes at a cost.
Right. And then, of course, just mechanically, like, as a party, the players can go, okay, well, in the next fight, Right. Like the paladin probably is not going to be good as a healer right now because like she's dealing with this stuff. I can keep that in mind right. if I'm the fighter.
And then as a GM, you also know that there's now these little wrinkles that you can throw into an encounter.
They're called children. They're people, okay?
Okay, yeah, for this example.
Unless they're Sahagin children, and then they're not
and
people.
Then they're not people. Right. You can save all the children, but not the British children. So yeah, so as a GM, though, you can take all of these little idiosyncrasies and wrinkles, and you can use them to sort of make your encounters more varied, right? Because now it's not just a straight fight with the hobgoblin general, right? Now it's a fight with a hobgoblin general and the goblin honor guard that you also have this competing interest in, this third party who is going to demand you don't just go bash them over the head. You have something else you have to handle too.
Mm-hmm. And what if the BBEG finds out about this new soft spot?
Oh dear.
It's leverage time.
Well, when you talk about the BBEG, now we're talking about other characters.
Ah. I love when fiction gives us the backstory of what we thought was an irredeemably evil character who was just sort of cacklingly evil. Mm-hmm. And you go, oh, that's how they got there. You know what? That's actually kind of understandable.
Yeah, I
kind of
don't blame you, man.
Uh-huh. But then next episode, they usually immediately cross the moral event horizon.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, oh, never mind. Never mind. Forget you. All right. Like, you need to die.
Right.
Immediately.
That's always the character of Barry. The rival spy Archer.
Right.
Like you're always like, man, Barry has a reason to be such a jerk all the time. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh no, but he just ate a child.
Right. He just took it to 11 again.
Yeah, like he just recreated the Last Supper with like murdered and tortured bodies. Like straight up Dark Eldar style. Yeah. Like,
I watched Handmaid's Tale and it was basically that, right? Yeah. You're like, oh, you were horrible people. Oh, I get some backstory about you. I understand why you're horrible. Oh my God. You know, but you just need to die immediately.
Right. So think of this from the other character's perspective, right? The simplest question, is redemption possible or is punishment possible? Like, how do they feel about that action? What's their view on it, and how firmly do they feel that? Are they willing to be proven wrong?
And depending on your religion, are those the same thing?
Yeah, yeah.
How do other characters, both characters at the table, but also NPCs that you're interacting with, how do they feel about the PC who fell, and how do they feel about the actions that led to the fall? Are they learning anything by watching this character fall, maybe flounder? Do they need to like go and sort of help pick them up, have an intervention? And does this affect how they're going to respond when similar circumstances happen or they fail as well? Or even the choices that they make in terms of like, do they keep their oath?
Yeah, it can serve as a wake-up call, especially when you get into like dark magic or irresponsible technology or those types of things, right? Like it's totally reasonable that you would have like a superhero team up who saw Iron Man's technology used for evil against them and said, no, we will not use any technology, right? I will fight with my hands and my superpowers and my super strength, and that's it. You could also have, you know, in more of the fantasy realm, like, okay, we reject necromancy outright now. Like we've seen what necromancy can do. It is terrible. We will not use necromancy as a party any longer. Throw away our wands. Burn our scrolls. Unlearn our spells, I guess. You'd probably need a little DM help to do that.
Modify memory.
Yeah.
I love the idea that some of the players, or you know, even like big NPCs, have the same oath that one character broke.
Right.
But through circumstance or because you're in a party, like traveling, there's no one else around for help, like you're still forced to work with them. But how do you feel about them? And then while traveling with them, you know, it becomes apparent that they had good reasons, or you see that even though they made one mistake, they're not terrible. It forces them to confront how they feel about the strictures of the oath that they have sworn.
Yeah. Yeah. That oath might get a lot softer. It might be a lot more intentional than it is literal.
Right.
So we've talked a little bit about BBEGs, but also think about other NPCs or orders or organizations and how they would respond to a character's actions. So, you know, will powerful people like the king or the nobility still deal with you directly or at all if you're now known as the ones who massacred that village in order to kill a single witch?
I guess it's time to start wearing masks.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about what PCs lose when they fall, but sometimes you gain things too. Like, suddenly the Thieves Guild has no problem talking to you.
Right, yeah.
Wait, you killed the king?
Step into my office. Isn't it so good to be bad?
And, you know, maybe the redemption arc is then, like, using that newfound access to take down the Thieves Guild from the inside.
Yeah, or, you know, going back to the BBEG idea, right? It's he recognizes something in you. And he's like, whoa, like, real recognize real. Come to my side. Like, we have coffee.
Real coffee.
Right.
Really, you just want to be playing Burn Notice, right?
Yeah, basically. That's actually exactly how Burn Notice works.
Right. Oh, Michael, you're stuck in Miami. But, you know, that comes with benefits, being off the books.
Yeah. You're still going to work for the CIA. But also, like, problem of the week.
You have some free time now to take on other clients,
yeah,
who will never pay you.
Right. So then the other thing you need to consider as an audience is the players themselves, the people at the table, not just their characters. So in other media, this would be like the reader or the viewer. But since in RPGs, the reader viewer is actually the actor, the player, it all kind of rolls together. But keep in mind that people have a reaction to what happens at the table as a piece of fiction, right? So if something very difficult to hear or listen to or watch happens at a table, a person has a reaction to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this works lightly for, like, that kind of selfish bad boy character, right? Like the Sawyer character from Lost or Jane in Firefly. You know, those characters are constantly screwing things up for selfish reasons, but they're, like, just likable enough that you still want to keep them around, right? The player likes the character, even though the characters are kind of have a good reason to push them out the airlock.
Yeah, and the other players also like the character. Like, if you think of that episode, Ariel, as an RPG session, sure, two other players are getting screwed over, but they probably know above the table that that's happening,
mm-hmm.
You know? And then everyone is watching while, like, the GM nearly spaces a character.
Yeah.
That's intense. Or I think about in our Dark Sun game, Steph is playing Bright Eyes, who was a defiler and has sworn an oath never to defile ever again, no matter what.
Right, because she's a member of our mercenary company, who that is basically our two rules are, like, honor the company and its contracts and don't defile.
Right. And it has been really cool to sort of watch what the character needs to do in order to uphold that oath at all costs.
Yeah.
You know, and on multiple levels, right? Like, I'm sure it's, like, cool for Steph while she's, like, playing the character. It's cool in the fiction of the game, watching, like, how Bright Eyes reacts when the rest of the company and she, like, come across a defiler.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, like, as players going, oh man, like, how's this going to play out?
Right. Yeah, it's always like, is this where she tells us? No.
No? Okay. Okay. That's right. Cool. That's, yeah, cool.
Keep on pretending then. I think this is also important to keep in mind when you're dealing with settings that are incongruous with modern sensibilities. Mm. So to go back to Dark Sun, right? Slavery is a huge theme in Dark Sun. Like, the Mull is an entire race of slaves, right? Which is not always the most comfortable thing to be engaged in at a role-playing game table, right? Like, I don't necessarily want to, like, be the master of a slave, even when we're playing pretend, and I definitely don't want to sit at a table with somebody who's getting off on that.
Right.
So, like, keep that audience in mind, right? So that if your character needs to engage in that behavior, right, that you are able to make clear that that's why it's happening, and, like, you don't want this to be, like, defining yourself, right? This is not my fun. This is just what I have to do. Let's get past this.
Yeah, I think that's something to keep in mind when you are running or playing like falling or fallen characters. You need to do a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know? But we've talked about before, like, if there's something that you want to occur in the fiction, but you don't actually want to, like, talk about it at the table, you can always, you know, bring down the black curtain.
Right.
You know, like, fade to black, this occurred. You notice people have much darker backstories than their current stories.
Yeah,
because always. People don't want to, like, play that out.
Right.
Yeah. But it's also possible that you just don't want that at the table, and that's fine. Just keep that in mind when you're figuring out exactly what a character needs to do in order to fall so that it is within like the comfort parameters of the table.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about social contract before, mm-hmm. and about where those lines are and how they're different for each player. So be aware of those. But as you brush up against those, just if that's the way that your character is going to fall, make sure that you're cognizant of that impact on the people around you.
Yeah, because a lot of times, you know, the breaking of the oath or the action that causes you to fall is sudden.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't necessarily want to spring it on the other players at the table.
Yeah, like, and this is the example that actually probably makes a little more sense, or at least comes up more often, is children. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of times, you know, you've got parents at the table or whatever, and that can be very personal, right? And so it's always good to just be like, look, my character feels like these kids have got to die. And so that's what I'm going to do unless somebody stops me. And like, we don't have to talk about this anymore. We can just move on.
Or we can roll initiative.
Yeah. Or you can stop me.
Right.
up to you guys. But I recognize that this is a very transgressive thing that I'm going to do.
Right. That my character is going to do.
That my character is going to do. Like, talk me out of it, stop me, do something, or let's just move past
it. Yeah, there have definitely been times when like someone is standing there with a D20 in hand, and they're like, is anyone going to talk me out of this? Because like, I'm doing this. Is someone going to make a persuasion check?
Right, right.
It's also possible that like, hey guys, turns out that's the fall and the redemption arc that we're having. The party's fighting.
Yeah. I'm going to pre-redeem you.
That's right. Actually, no kids are dying today.
Right.
But someone's getting stabbed.
So then one last thing about redemption arcs in general is just you can also invert them, right? So lean into your new normal. And this might not even necessarily like cause you to leave the campaign or leave the party. You might now just be able to do the dirty work because that's who you are now. But think of like the fallen paladin who seeks to prove the hypocrisy of his former order, right? Which is basically Darth Vader.
Yeah, the one that abandoned him, and now I'm going to show everyone the lie of the Jedi.
Right.
Now you're a Grey Guard. At the same time, when you have a character pursuing redemption, it can be cool if they get right up to it and then start second-guessing, wait, is this the redemption that I want? Because the sort of normal trope is, okay, you killed my family member, well, now I go kill you.
Yeah, like cathartic release, like great, it's done.
Right. But what happens if they're finally face-to-face with the killer and they have second thoughts about whether they want to kill this person or whether that will even offer them the redemption that they're looking for?
Right.
It might actually be that they do kill them, but that is not the end of the redemption arc.
Right.
That does not grant it.
That might actually just be kind of a further step down the spiral.
Right.
Right.
I mean, to bring up Spider-Man again, right? Like, it's a fairly simple arc, but like he finds Uncle Ben's killer.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't kill him.
No, he also doesn't feel any better about it.
Yeah,
he still decides to become a crime-fighting vigilante, cleaning up the streets of New York City.
So, actually, playing this out in a game can work in several different ways. You could have the fall happen off-screen, and then most of the redemption occurs on screen. This is typically when you have like the backstory.
The fallen backstory.
Right, right. I did terrible things and now I'm level one.
I'm questing to make up for it.
Right.
You can also have the character fall on screen and then be redeemed on screen. And that's sort of the campaign arc for your character.
Yeah. I find it's also useful if you have someone who's gotten kind of bored of their character. So like, you know, six levels in, character falls, character becomes an NPC, they bring in a new character. It's quite possible that that second character dies.
And you bring back
number one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then cue redemption arc.
Yeah. Nothing like calling an ex-girlfriend, right? And then one that probably happens less often but is still possible is that the PC has his fall on screen but then is redeemed off screen, right? And a lot of times that happens when things are very personal and or a campaign kind of ends suddenly and you have to epilogue or you know, the party just moves in a different direction and it's sort of handled on a more personal level sort of with the GM. It can kind of become headcanon more than game canon at that point.
Right.
But it's fitting that this topic comes up right now. We've just finished this series on tribality talking about brand, and we've gotten a listener question a few weeks ago that was kind of asking about some of the stuff that went on with brand as a player. So I've been thinking about this a lot. So this is kind of good timing. But I realized that brand had multiple falls over the course of Morning Glory as a literal fallen inquisitor, right? Mm-hmm. And actually hit all three of those kind of implementations of it, right? So his background was that he was an excommunicated inquisitor who was responsible for a massacre during the last war and was charged by the church of bringing another inquisitor to justice, right? Nistrum Shadar, who was kind of our big bad. The massacre was part of Brand's backstory, but chasing down Nistrum Shadar was basically the first 16 levels of the campaign. So I spent a long time trying to redeem myself.
Right. And one of the reasons that the party trusted Brand in the first place is that, like, when they were introduced to him, he's on this redemption arc.
Right.
You know, I'm going to do this thing because I did some bad things.
Right. and then he also had a fall on screen that was redeemed on screen, and that was his sort of question of faith. When he became a dragon sorcerer and was very lampshadingly different, you know, walking out of a portal, he lost his faith in the Silver Flame, began evangelizing for the dead dragon god Sybaris. And,
annoyingly so.
Yeah, liability-wise.
Greetings, friend. Have I told you about Sybaris?
And then ultimately, though, Brand returns to his faith, is sort of stronger than ever in the Silver Flame, and actually defeats Belshalor the Shadow in the Flame and restores Jayla Darren the Keeper to lead Thrain.
And also ends the Silver Flame.
And also kills his own god, which is, you know, we're all better off for it.
That's a pretty fascinating redemption.
Yeah.
I don't think the Silver Flame is really my god. Oh, no, it definitely is, and it needs to die.
Right. For everyone's good. For our good and the good of all his church. And then finally, the kind of fall on screen, redeem off screen, right? We ended up sort of, because in the final session, Bastion betrayed us, we ended up in this sort of Morning Glory civil war between Brand and Emery over what to do with Bastion's eternal soul, right? Emery insists that he should be redeemed and that there's still good in him and he should have a second chance. And Brand is like, no, he's too evil. He tried to screw over the whole multiverse. We need to make sure he never comes back because he is the first to sixth most powerful being in this galaxy or in this multiverse.
One of these days, we'll need to figure out exactly what happens.
I solved it. I'm going to boil the sea.
All right, so you don't need to create a character with an idea that they are going to fall and that they will redeem themselves, right? When you are sort of laying out the arc of a character over the course of a campaign, story-wise, you don't need to put in all of the like ups and downs. But as you play them, lots of times you'll notice, like, oh, here's a decision that I think would be in character but would really like change their story. And when those present themselves, consider them. Like, really seriously consider them, because even if in the short term it takes a character in a direction that you don't really want them to end up at, it can be very interesting for everybody to sort of help swing them back out of it.
Yeah, I don't think you need to force the arc on a character, unless you start with it as your backstory, right? Obviously, that's making the decision up front. But over the course of a campaign, just being open to it and kind of keeping your eyes open for the possibility, I think will make it more organic and then also more enjoyable, right? Like the payoff of finally being redeemed of your great folly is so much better when it all feels natural.
Yeah, and GMs keep an eye out for players who might be open to that.
Yeah, and if you see a possibility, talk to the player about it, please. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
That is the silence of dead children. It's all I hear at night when I sleep.
It's fine. They're British children. So let's move on to the Character Creation Forge. Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we have the Curse Breaker.
Oh, the Curse Breaker. The point of this build is to be the best at counterspelling and casting dispel magic, because all of those terrible spellcasters going around and mucking things up and casting curses on people and putting, you know, strange enchantments on stuff that really should belong in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
Someone needs to go fix all that.
And who is just the person to do that?
Probably a Lore Bard 14, Tome Fiendlock 6.
Okay, so Lore Bard 14 is going to be good, right? We're going to have 7th level spells.
Yeah, Bard 14 base is always a great character.
Right. You're going to get Jack of All Trades, so you'll have a +3 on all ability checks if you don't add your proficiency bonus.
Right, which is the ability checks for counterspell and dispel magic.
Mm-hmm.
Also initiative.
And initiative, yeah. You'll get plenty of skills and 4 expertises.
Probably Arcana and Religion are really good. I also like the idea of stealth, so that you could like sneak in and break someone's like magic.
Oh yeah,
without
yeah,
them
yeah.
knowing.
Yeah, great.
I love that you get cutting words, so you can use a bardic inspiration to like reduce someone's attack roll or damage roll, but you can also use it to reduce their ability check. So I love the fact that you can insult somebody while they're trying to cast dispel magic or to counter one of your spells, and that fizzles.
Yeah. I counterspell, bet you don't.
Yeah.
Dang!
And at level 14, you get Peerless Skill, which lets you drop one of your D10 bardic dice onto an ability check, which of course is counterspell or dispel magic.
Right. And then 6 levels of Warlock. We're going to take Tome, so we'll get some extra cantrips, which will of course be guidance to get a +d4.
You get 3 invocations. 2 of them that I like, Devil's Sight, so you can see in magical darkness. Because remember, you can only counter something within 60 feet that you can see being cast. And Eldritch Sight, which is detect magic at will, which, like, if your job is to go around and break curses, like, you want to be able to always tell what magic is up.
Yeah. You'll also get Dark One's Own Luck, which lets you add a D10 to an ability check every short rest.
And for your race, I think if you are someone who's traveling with a big party a lot of the time, you probably want to be a hobgoblin, because they get an ability called Saving Face, which lets them add to a roll with a bonus equal to the number of allies around them.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people watching them and waiting for them to fail.
Yep.
And if you travel alone, I would go with Halfling, because you get to reroll that 1, which prevents devastating failure. So when you cast a counterspell or you're casting dispel magic, you're making an ability check with your spellcasting ability that the DC is 10 plus the level of the spell that you're trying to dispel or counter.
Right. As long as the spell is higher level than the level you cast counterspell or dispel magic.
Right.
Which will basically always be casting it at 3rd level.
Because on this ability check, you've got a D20 base +8. You're going to have a +5 charisma modifier, and you get another +3 from the Jack of All Trades.
Okay.
So you can just do that normally. That gives you, I believe, a 50% chance of dispelling or countering an 8th level spell.
Right. But then you've got some abilities to throw on that as well.
Right. You can throw on a bardic die if you want. You can use Dark One's Own Luck. You've got guidance, and also you've got your hobgoblin ability. That's giving you on average, you can counter or dispel a spell of level like 22.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty good.
Considering mortal magic stops at 9. And I believe in the Forgotten Realms fiction, the spell that like killed the goddess of magic and like ruined one entire edition of the Forgotten Realms to make way for a new edition, that was level 12, a level 12 spell. That's not a problem for you to counter.
If you're worried about those ones, though, you've also got access to enhance ability. So you can make sure that you're rolling it with advantage, which will then, you know, mitigate the downside on that.
That's right. If you're not looking for highest possible, but you're looking for consistency.
Right. Yeah. If you always want to counter level 9 spells, because perhaps level 10 spells haven't been written in your current edition yet.
All right. So, Shane, what is your curse breaker?
So my curse breaker has actually been the victim of a Gesh spell.
Oh.
But rather than break his own curse, he sort of leans into it, right? He wants to ensure that this type of magic is never used against anybody else ever again. And so I'm thinking maybe once he had Gesh cast upon him, he broke the spell, then cast it on himself. So that he could always be obligated to do this, right? He wants to he's sort of a proponent of free will.
Puts his magic where his mouth is.
Yeah, exactly. So he believes in the high ideal of free will and doesn't want anybody to be suffering from undue influence ever, particularly the nasty influence of magic.
That's very noble.
How about you?
My curse breaker steals things. It's a tomb raider.
Oh, okay.
Right? Delving into ancient pyramids and crypts, which are always littered with curses and traps and magical like defenses.
Nice.
So, okay. Up against this wall, it's got a force field. I guess I will... Oh, turn it off.
Right.
Yeah. There we go. oh no, you're casting a curse on me. It's a withering curse. What am I gonna... Oh, I'll just dispel it. There we go. That was easy. Of course, you know, no, we didn't mention this, but you should definitely take the remove curse spell as a bard, like with magical secrets.
Right.
Do that. And of course, then, you know, gathers idols and things, make sure that there are no lingering curses, and brings them back to the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
What is the value of those items without the curse on them?
They have historical value, obviously.
Okay,
they belong in a museum.
Right. Great. All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher and Google Play. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithms will help other people find us.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
Well, we are answering mailbag questions and we'll be celebrating our 100th episode with a big announcement.
And in the character creation forge?
We're building Baron Munchausen.
Well, that's it for episode 99 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.